working. OK, so first of all, thank you so much for having me. This has been one of the most fun conferences I've been to. So today, we're going to change gears a little bit, but it's still somewhat related. And I'm going to talk about how we are going to measure the stellar local velocity, and more importantly, how it actually might affect direct detection of experiments of dark matter. So very quick review. Direct detection is one of the three ways that we know in and from which we can actually detect dark matter. So dark matter, let me see, right here, OK, cool. Dark matter comes in, scatters off a standard model particle, and that produces some kind of signal that we detect, and that's how we know dark matter is there. I really like this Lux video where dark matter comes in, it's a black dot, hits a heavy xenon atom, and that causes some scintillation light, which we then detect, and that's how we know dark matter was there. Great. Well, the problem is that this process really depends on a lot of different parameters, a lot of astrophysics, particle physics, a lot of things, but I would like to actually focus on one very specific thing, which is the rate dependence on the local velocity distribution of dark matter. So basically, the way we convolve a lot of these parameters here is the way is the reason that why we make plots like this that you've seen probably a lot of times, where here the x-axis we have is the dark matter mass, the y-axis is the dark matter nucleon cross-section, and a lot of these experiments are actually ruling out more and more parameter space. These are the latest, this is the latest limit from xenon 1-ton from last year, where basically everything above this black line here has been ruled out. Everything is nice here, but you have to kind of think about it a little bit, because to make this plot, we had to assume that the velocity distribution of dark matter is actually Maxwellian, the Maxwell-Boltzmann that peaks at 220 and everything. The problem with that is, in order to actually get to the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, we really had to assume two key assumptions, which is that the system is isotropic and the system is in equilibrium. Which both of these assumptions from like the series of talks that we've heard about this week can tell you that maybe this is not the right thing. The system is not that perfectly in equilibrium. It's definitely not isotropic. So what we want to do is actually find an empirical way to measure the local velocity of distribution of dark matter. So how can we measure the velocity of something we can't see? Well, we go with the second best thing, which is actually find stars that behave somewhat like the dark matter and measure their velocities. So this goes into a three-step program where, from simulations, we find that accreted stars trace the velocity of their dark matter counterparts. And by dark matter counterparts, I mean the same dark matter that actually was brought in with these accreted stars. And we'll go into a bit more detail in a little bit. Once you establish that correlation, which, again, has some caveats and I'm sure will be up to a lot of debate, we go into the Gaia data and actually measure the local velocity distribution of these accreted stars. And finally, we put one and two together and try to get the dark matter velocity distribution. Step three is a lot harder than you think, and we'll get to that in a little bit. So what I really want to emphasize before we go forward is that the only thing that we're getting out of the simulation is the physics, basically that the dark matter and the stars really do correlate with each other. None of the distributions that I will show in the end and none of the limits really actually rely on the distributions that we get from the simulations. There has been a lot of work over the years about getting the velocity distribution from the simulations, which is actually really great. The problem is that these simulations do not reflect the exact merger history of the Milky Way, which is really what we were trying to get at here. So everything ends up being empirical. Having said that, I'm going to start by showing you some cool video that I think you've seen already like three times from the FIRE simulation. FIRE stands for Feedback in Realistic Environments. For any related questions, ask Andrew or Robin or a lot of other people. But the interesting thing is that the reason that I shared this video is there are a lot of mergers that actually contribute to getting us a Milky Way-like galaxy at redshift zero. So what I would really like to do is to kind of break it down into different stages. This is overly simplistic, but it kind of gets the picture across. All right, so what happens? First, we have a small dwarf galaxy that is kind of falling into the Milky Way. And basically, we have the stars and the dark matter. And the entire object is really falling into the Milky Way. So basically, when you were trying to look at the velocity of these star particles, the stars, or the dark matter, it's going to be kind of, it's not really a delta function, but it's going to be quite narrow and thin because the entire object is really just kind of smashing into the Milky Way. After that, we end up with a stage of a stream where things kind of start getting tidally disrupted, and there have been amazing videos across. And here, the stars and the dark matter, this is actually kind of gets a bit questionable, that the stars and the dark matter follow each other. It's not really true because basically the stars are really in the bottom of the potential well, so there has been some kind of space between them, so as you rip them apart, they're not really going to land exactly in the same places, so you have to be very, very careful. But the third stage, which is the one that I really want to focus on, is that of a debris flow. So I know there has been a lot of terminology about, you know, moving objects, streams, debris flow. It's just like one more word that we need to add to the vocabulary. But basically what I mean by debris flow is structure in velocity space, which is not structure in physical space. So the way I like to think about it is that if you have a stream here that has done a lot of different orbits over and over, so much so that you can't really tell if a star is like on the first orbit, second orbit, so they're really clumped up on top of each other, but you're kind of crossing a section there and you have a population of stars, you will still see that their velocity has some structure coming from, you know, kind of telling you about the origin of that object. Okay. So, having defined the stages that are really going to focus on, let's start by looking at the velocity distributions in the solar neighborhood from the simulation. So we're going to start with the most boring case. So here, what I'm plotting are histograms in velocity and spherical coordinates. So we have here VR, this is V theta, and this is V phi. And these, the particles that I'm really plotting, they're all next to what we call the solar neighborhood in my simulation. And they've all been accreted at redshift higher than 3. Okay? So these are all very, very old mergers that just came in here. So the interesting thing, of course, number one, dark matter and these accreted stars do follow each other. Of course, again, this is kind of a cheat because I know which particles have been accreted, I know the stars that have been accreted. The world kind of is not, unfortunately, it's not this easy. I would also like to emphasize that things kind of are a lot more phase mixed. So basically, these kind of look like really nice Gaussians, which technically, if you put these together, more or less, they're going to give you something very close to the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution that we really generally assume with these things. as you all know, stars don't come in with labels, so you can't really tell which star has been accreted. For that, we use the metallicity as a proxy, more or less, and this is just for the old component. I want to make that very, very clear. So in the simulation, if you look at the stars with metallicity less than minus 2, you end up more or less tracing that distribution. Okay? Of course, that cutoff of minus 2 really depends on the simulation, on the merger history, so it's not something that we're going to take really to heart. All right, so we already kind of have gone through the boring case. Let's go through something a little bit more interesting. A case of debris flow. All right, so this, again, here, VR, V theta, V phi histograms, stars in red, dark matter in black. And this is a very specific merger that I picked, and you will see later why I picked exactly this one. The properties of this particular merger are not really, really the most important. It came in at redshift 0.9. It has a mass of 8, 10 to the 10 solar masses. It contributes a non-negligible fraction of the local accreted stars and the local accreted dark matter. But basically, actually, I have in the appendix of the paper, we have like a series of mergers, and they all kind of trace each other in the case of debris flow, not in the case of streams. And this is really, really cool, because it didn't have to work that well. Okay. So the most important point, dark matter and stars do follow each other when they're coming from the same origin. So we have to kind of trace back, figure out the same halo, and then trace it back forward in time to redshift 0. But another thing that I really want to focus on is the radial velocity distribution. So let's zoom in on this. So basically, there is this bimodal distribution here in VR, where it can be explained as, you can imagine that if you have a sphere and you're kind of shooting an arrow through it, you're going to end up with basically with a peak for the stuff that's coming in, peak at negative minus 250, for example, and then the stuff that's coming out is 250. So, and then, of course, like the orbit is going to come back, so it's not just like going through. So basically, this we end up with this kind of lobe structure. I think recently I said those words and somebody told me that lobe is not a word. I'm really sorry, hashtag immigrant, so I don't know. But you know what I'm talking about. All right, so to kind of really kind of hammer out this idea, I liked, and also because I got obsessed with making videos, I would like to actually show you the stars and the particle, the stars and the dark matter particles from this particular merger if we run them backward in time. Okay, so the reason, so there is like this fishnet here and here. The stars and the dark matter are supposed to be on top of each other. They're separated just so we can see actually something. The reason that the particles are actually selected as a donut is because that's the basically the solar neighborhood that I picked. So we have distances from basically 6 to 10 kiloparsec and less than 1.5 kiloparsec, plus or minus 1.5 kiloparsec around the disk. So what we do is to run this backwards, and you can see the redshift here. So first of all, you can see that the stars and the dark matter are really very well dispersed. This is going to this is confirming the idea that this is a debris flow, it's not a stream. And then as we run it backwards, it's going to end up, you can actually see the structure kind of coming together a little bit more, and it gets a little bit streamier before actually seeing the initial object that fell in back in the simulation. And it is just time for me to drink something. Pause it too quickly, but yeah. Okay, so basically, these stars kind of have, they come in from the same merger, follow the dark matter, end up in the solar neighborhood, and we can use them to actually go back to the velocity distribution of the dark matter, again, at redshift zero. Okay. I swear I didn't drink coffee, but apparently I'm speaking way too fast today. So, now the big question is, I mean, the simulations are nice and beautiful, but the question is, what does the Milky Way really look like, right? And for that, we use Gaia, and I don't think I have to really say a lot of stuff. Gaia is awesome. Launched December 2013, 1 billion stars, all the whole deal that we already know. And I actually like to show this plot. Basically, this is the extent of Hipparchus beforehand, and this is where Gaia extends with the same errors. And when I first showed this, at some point, somebody was like, don't be mean to Hipparchus. I'm like, I'm not. I'm just saying Gaia's awesome. That's not the point. Okay, so from Gaia, and especially from Gaia DR2, some people even in the room, including Vasily, actually found new structures. So the Gaia Enceladus. Enceladus apparently is a Greek god who is son of Gaia, and this is beautiful, it's coming out of the Milky Way. Sorry, Vasily, I really tried to make a sausage coming out of the Milky Way, but it's highly inappropriate. It's ridiculously bad, so no. Sorry. So, this new structure actually has a lot of implications for dark matter. We still kind of are a bit uncertain about a lot of its properties, but we know that the stellar mass is somewhere between 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9. It came in somewhere between redshift 1 and 3, and has an average metallicity close to minus 1.4. But I really like Dennis's video of basically we have the Milky Way here, it comes in, and then you can see it kind of being a stream kind of sort of very quickly, and then it elongates into this peanut sausage structure. What I would like to emphasize is that the scale here, I don't know if you can read it, but this is 0, this is 25 kiloparsecs. So actually, we live here. So from our perspective, it's really everywhere. We cannot really tell the smaller structure of it, which is why this would qualify as debris flow. All right, so what did we do about this? Well, these awesome people kind of studied and presented us with this new structure. Well, what I ended up doing is actually using data from Gaia cross-matched with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey to actually try to model the velocity distribution as well as the metallicity of all the different components. The goal is to find the velocities of the particular components that are going to translate to the dark matter and take them there. So, So here we have VR, V theta, V phi, and this is the metallicity distribution. And I'm fitting everything all at once. So it ends up, I think, being 35 different parameters, actually, of these multi-Gaussians. So let's kind of go through the different elements and make sure that what I'm doing is actually makes sense. So in green, at first, we have what we call it, what we're going to label as the disk distribution. So the disk is going, it has a mean of 0 in VR, a mean of 0 in V theta, but it has a non-trivial V phi, as we expect, because basically the disk needs to rotate. The peak here is at 180, and the reason that it's a bit lower is because I mass everything below 2.5 kiloparsec. You might wonder that that's a little bit extreme, and the reason we do that is because it, well, modeling the disk has been very, very difficult, and we're currently trying to work on that. But at the time, we tried to kind of sidestep the issue of asymmetric drift to be able to get some results. And of course, the metallicity of the population that we call the disk is peaking at minus 0.7, so that makes sense. Beyond that, we have an isotropic component. And just to be clear, a lot of these priors are actually really, really large. So we're not trying to constrain them to fit exactly this. So the fit really picks up the right elements at the same time. So the distribution is more or less isotropic in VR, V theta, and V phi. And it picks up the most metal poor component with peaking at velocity peak at minus one, with the metallicity peak at minus 1.82. Great. Now we have this substructure, which I modeled here as two overlapping Gaussians that basically the space between them could have been adjusted. We can see again that it picks up this Loewy structure. And the metallicity that it picks is actually, it's somewhere in between, so it's actually minus 1.4 in this case. So it is a population that is more metal poor than the disk and more metal rich than the halo. So the reason why this is somewhat interesting is that it actually looks close, this is actually the data, it looks close to the structures, and we have quite a few of these, that we found in the simulation. So what I really want to also emphasize here is that this is not that sub of a structure, because I've been referring to it as substructure all the way through the paper. And basically, within the within our data set, this ends up having a fraction of about 60-65% of non-disk component, basically of the cratered component. So in the solar neighborhood, basically, this is telling us that at least this component is really contributing quite a lot. Of course, this comes with a huge caveat that we only modeled above 2.5 kiloparsec. So translating that to Z of 0 is still a bit of a stretch. And we're working on it as really high and non-trivial. All right. So from that, let's try to understand how this affects direct detection. The problem is mergers do not really contribute the same amounts of dark matter that they do stars, which means that when I said that this particular merger contributes about 60% of the accreted stars, that doesn't mean it contributes 60% of the accreted dark matter. That just doesn't work that way. So for that, we actually had to kind of think really hard about how can we estimate the fractions correctly. The way we ended up doing it is actually try to use known empirical distributions and try to actually get something relating this ratio between the dark matter and the stars to quantities that we already know. So for that, we're going to use the stellar mass metallicity relation here from Kirby 2013, and then kind of convolve it with the stellar mass total mass relation to actually end up with a relationship between the metallicity, the average metallicity of an incoming object, which we know how to get to, and the ratio of dark matter to stars that this has contributed. So putting these two empirical relations, again, these are not simulations whatsoever, together, we end up with this relationship. So this is the metallicity on the x-axis here, and then on the y-axis, we have the total mass divided by the stellar mass contributed from that object. you can see, so these colors here is just, it's just a Monte Carlo, but we can see that there is quite a bit of spread here. And the spread is actually mainly coming from this, from the stellar mass total mass relation that we get from abundance matching. But you can actually do that, and then you can actually pick where, well, choose where the substructure is and where the halo is, and you can take those ratios to figure out exactly the relative contributions. Not the absolute contribution, but the relative contributions. So before doing, applying that to data, we took the equivalent of these relationships in the fire simulations and actually applied we did this exercise on the fire simulation to actually make sure that everything is really consistent and we're not missing something huge. So here, what I'm plotting is a histogram of the speed distribution, not VR, but VR actually does similar things. I am not sure if you can actually see the shades of gray in the background, but basically, these shades of gray here, these stacked histograms, are actually the different contributions in dark matter. Okay? So basically, in the background here, we have the relaxed component, which is the old stuff, more than redshift, coming from redshift larger than 3. And then we have actually two mergers that are non-trivial in this particular simulation, so we kind of put them on top of each other and try to get that to fit. So the colored distributions, on the other hand, on top here are actually the stellar distributions rescaled by the factor that I get from this relationship over here. You might think, well, it looks okay, but it doesn't look so great. Yes, because there are associated error bars that we get out of the scatter from this relationship, which I have not shown here because that would be a bit too cumbersome, but we actually apply to the data, as I will show you in a little bit. Great, so kind of we have a game plan, but what I really want to emphasize is what is the logic behind all this, okay? Just to kind of go back and have a big picture of what am I trying to do. What I'm trying to do is actually kind of construct the dark matter velocity distribution component by component. And the reason I say this is because we're not going to just take a population of the accreted stars or the old stars and just say, and try to fit them with all the dark matter and then just say, oh, this doesn't fit, so something must be wrong. What I'm doing is that I'm picking the older mergers and then the younger mergers and then the debris flows and trying to construct the dark matter distribution of these components, rescaling them appropriately, adding them one by one. You can see here that there will be components that I still cannot get to, but hopefully that is work in the future. So again, really emphasizing the strategy, the overall strategy is to actually reconstruct the dark matter component by component. And it doesn't mean that we have all the components yet. Okay, so drum roll, we get the new velocity distribution. It is the sum of the contribution from the halo in that of the substructure. The ratio here from that relationship that I told you actually includes pretty large error bars, highly non-trivial, because, again, of the scatter of this relationship. So here I'm showing the speed distribution of the different components. In blue is the substructure, halo is red. Both of these components are empirically found, so they are the ones that I'm fitting for before. I'm not assuming that the halo is Maxwell-Boltzmann or anything. And you put them together, and then this is the error bar that's coming from here. So there are a few things, huge caveats that I really need to mention. Again, we're building this component by component, but the big question is, are we missing some components? And of course we are, because this only applies for subhalos or for mergers that really have stars in them, which means that if I have objects that are merging in and they have no stars associated with them, I'm going to miss them in this method. It just doesn't work. So we do, unfortunately, we can do this only in the simulations where I can actually look and see, oh, these are the distributions of, for example, from dark subhalos, and I can see those distributions, I can see that fraction, but again, I promised you that all the distributions that I show in the end are empirical, so I cannot, we cannot really discuss it that way, but it is something that we're really thinking about. And another point that I really wanted to focus on is that, because if you look at this number and you say, wait, this is a little bit too large from what I remember, this fraction is taken with respect to the luminous satellite fraction. It's not taken with respect with all the dark matter locally. So this is, it must be larger than the local dark matter contribution. from the substructure. But being aware of all of this, we have the final distribution, which is here. Again, it's missing components. This is not the final deal. It's not what the experimentalists should put in their experiment and just run away with it. But it is one step towards that goal. So if we just wanted to really understand how does this affect direct detection, so you can see here the dashed gray is the standard halo model. So this is what we usually assume, right? And this is the new found distribution. Again, we can be in the situation where the missing components, thank you, the missing components are actually just going to pull this distribution close to the standard halo model, in which case, well, at least I can tell myself that at least we understand where that comes from, but you know, hopefully this wouldn't have been a waste. But if it is like this, I just really want to emphasize that this has non-trivial effects on direct detection. So we go back to the initial plot of the exclusion plot of here we have the dark matter mass on the x-axis again, and then the y-axis we have the dark matter scattering cross-section. And basically, this dashed line is what you would expect from the standard halo model, so from the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And with this new distribution, everything kind of gets pulled here. Okay, so it gets pulled to the right because basically the standard halo model might be overly constraining. And this is a problem because you don't really want to be, if you're conservative, that's fine, but you don't want to be ruling out more parameter space than you have to. Another thing that I want to actually mention, but very briefly, is that this affects different experiments differently. So basically, some distributions are going to move, some distributions are not going to move too much, which means that the relative competitive direct detection of like, who's doing best at which regime might be a little bit different, which is why it is something you really kind of keep attention, pay attention to. Effects on different operators need investigation. Basically, if you assume this, basically just telling us that the hard scattering is different from if you have a mediator, if the physics is a little bit different. And I think I will have a few minutes to actually tell you just one last thing. This also affects modulation. So basically, you have the solar system here, and it's moving into the Milky Way, and dark matter comes at it here. But basically, the velocity is going to be different in June versus December, so this is what we call the yearly modulation. The thing is, if the dark matter is not isotropic, which is the case of for contribution from the sausage, for example, this will lead to non-trivial modulation effects. And basically, if I scan through that error bar, you can see here that the distribution is going to be peaking at different energies than what you would otherwise expect. So this gets me to my conclusions. Stars trace the velocity of dark matter. Yes, that's a very bold statement, but it has a lot of caveats that I really hope I actually got across today. This is only true for merging satellites, and it is not quite true for streams. This is true for for debris flow, things that have kind of sinked in a little bit longer ago. This doesn't work for things that don't have any stars in them at all, like smooth accretion or dark subhalos. But it's still an interesting way of kind of trying to empirically measure the velocity distribution of dark matter, which is accreted from luminous satellites. So it is a step in the right direction. And the fact that we live in a huge debris flow that really affects our direct detection limits is really, really cool. But there is a lot more to do, so I thought throw in the laundry list of things that we want to do. Generalized to mergers that have been talked about here. Modeling down to the solar position, not stopping at 2.5 and having people pretty upset. They were like, oh, well, you know, the extrapolation, who knows if it holds. We are going to do that. We want to also estimate the fraction of dark matter from the non-luminous satellites and their velocities, again, empirically. So really, we're still kind of thinking about it. We want to understand the correlation between the dark matter and the stars in case of extreme, because basically the flat-out exercise that we did, things don't fit exactly right. And finally, we're trying to expand this to self-interacting dark matter. And this is a bit of, it might be a bit ironic or confusing statement, but basically what I'm trying to say is that this whole thing assumed that the stars and the dark matter are actually are both collisionless. Otherwise, none of this holds. So we, in the FIRE collaboration, we have actually a self-interacting simulation. And the first thing that I did is to actually do it. And you can very easily see that, again, the stars and the dark matter do not follow each other anymore. So that breaks down. But we're still trying to, we're actually playing with a few things. So maybe we'll come up with new observables for the case of self-interacting dark matter. So for that, stay tuned. Thank you. All right, let's get this started.
So it seems like one of the most one of the most interesting parts of this is the question of when the experiments hit the neutrino floor, and whether, you know, how you shift these curves. In some sense, the experiments didn't care until now. There's a real point at a certain cross section when they think.
That's right. Yes, and you might basically, so basically these distributions, yeah. So the way that you actually work out these limits is the way you kind of take the distribution like this and take it, sorry, I will answer your question. I just want to explain what you were trying to say to everyone. So the way that we go from a velocity distribution to kind of a rate or and that limit plot is by integrating f of v, this one, from a v min here all the way to the end. Okay? So basically, this the effects of the changes of the distribution, it all kind of matters in the tail. The problem is this kind of the position from which you start integrating actually depends on the dark matter mass and on the experimental threshold. Which is why, for different experiments, this is going to be a bit different because every experiment has a different threshold. So what he's mentioning here is that here, yeah, you can. So we have these plots, but basically in here, in this limit plot, you actually have something. Well, it's a bit lower, but it's like about here, where your direct detection experiments are going to start detecting neutrinos as dark matter, which is actually really mind-bogglingly cool if it wasn't, you know, so disruptive. So the point that you're trying to make is that if the velocity distribution actually shifts, that might affect when you're going to hit the neutrino floor. And this is actually really important. We still have a couple of orders of magnitude that we'll get to in the next upgrades. But yes, this is really important to actually make sure that we understand this, because otherwise, you might start be looking at dark matter and ruling them out as neutrinos, which is not so great. Of course, there is a future there where basically the future of direct detection is going to be directional dark matter, directional experiment detection, where you know where the stuff is coming from. The most of the background is coming from the most of the neutrinos are coming from the sun. So if you can rule that out, you can look for dark matter. Sorry, that was long-winded. Yes, ma'am.
So first a comment, then a question.
Sure.
In these kind of experiments, mm-hmm. the distribution that matters is the distribution of speeds, or more particularly, it's the low moments of the distribution of speeds, depending on what scattering you're considering. And so you can change the velocity distribution, mm-hmm. say the radial velocity distribution, quite a bit.
Yeah.
But you don't change these moments very much. And so it's very difficult to get a very significant signal, and that's what Kieran O'Hare showed. And second,
but you might have non-trivial effects like the modulation, actually.
It doesn't make very much difference to the modulation.
It does.
But can we go back to your distribution of speed of so I'm not sure I actually understand this. Mm-hmm. Is this gray curve?
Yeah.
The one that you're proposing. So you are actually saying that the effect of all this accretion is to make the velocity distribution colder, so there are fewer things
on the
at
tail.
High speed.
Right.
That's very counterintuitive.
Yes.
It's also against all preceding analyses of N-body experiments, of this work by Kulin that showed right. that it was the effect of substructure in N-body simulations was to make the tail
That's right.
at high speeds much larger.
That's right.
And we've also done a calculation with all the substructures that Myong has, so yep. directly from the data, ascribing yep. a dark matter fraction from simulations to those substructures. And we find the same effect as Kulin, that the distribution of speeds is greater at larger speeds. So
yes.
Instead of a colder, we get a hotter distribution at larger speeds. So why is that?
Great. Okay, so it is indeed counterintuitive. So basically what you want, what most people think about is that you have, you know, the Maxwell-Boltzmann, and then you have another substructure sitting on top of it, okay? The thing is, we always were only, I think there was some kind of selection, but that we only cared about the ones that are sitting here. But basically, these incoming mergers, they come in at all different speeds, and some of them might be a lot slower than what you would expect. So they don't all have to sit here. They don't all have to be at 600 kilometers a second. And basically, what we're finding is that from the analysis of the Gaia sausage, it seems to be slower than what you would, the halo, which is why it's actually bringing the distribution a lot colder to the left.
But if I just look at the distribution of speeds,
yes,
height of stuff that has been accreted, the sort of stars above a characteristic energy,
mm-hmm.
I would get I would get a long tail to high speeds.
Yes.
So it's very counterintuitive, your result, and I haven't really gotten to the bottom of why it is. I mean, the Gaia sausage is just one of a number of accreted structures.
So yes,
really,
which is the only
one.
Absolutely. This is the only one that we're adding here, which is why in the conclusion I said that we need to add the other mergers. Second, I'm actually doing analysis just to address your particular point, because we discussed this 6 months ago, what I'm trying to do is actually model basically the tail of the distribution alone with the different components and actually get to that. So hopefully in a month, maybe, we'll get that paper out and you will see it. Yes.
Charmin. Hi, Lina. Really nice talk. I really like the idea that you took of taking like empirical relations, such as like the mass metallicity relation and halo mass,
mm-hmm.
Stellar mass relation. But I mean, there's also something that, you know, we see also, for example, for galaxies like the sausage, if it was some type of like LMC-like object, it's that, you know, there is actually quite a diversity. Well, there's also a diversity in rotation curves that we see,
mm-hmm.
and that also changes sort of the amount of dark matter that you can have locked
yes.
at a fixed
right.
a fixed stellar mass.
That's right.
Or halo mass as well.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, like, have you thought of like perhaps including sort of the fact that there is actually a diversity
yeah.
in rotation curves, and so you would expect a diversity of sort of a basically, I guess, concentration between the baryonic and the dark matter component. Because, you know, simulations generally, like, give you one trend, but they mm-hmm. never get the scatter.
Yes, okay. No, this is a really good point. So what we were worried about, actually, I think this is somewhat related, but not exactly right. So definitely I will look into the diversity, because I haven't done that. What we were worried about is that if the ratio of the stars to dark matter of isolated objects actually does change all the way down to the Milky Way. So that's the bit that we actually checked in simulation. And it seems to be, yes, the losses, there is a loss and the fraction does change, but basically kind of the rate at which you butcher things all the way down very close to the center, which is where we are, is kind of consistent. So that ratio is, basically, it was the same for different mergers, which is why if you take in the relative ratio, it kind of sort of holds up, but it is non-trivial. But I'll definitely also look at the diversity.
It's not exactly what
you're saying. It's not what you would
say.
Right?
Like, what I want to say is that, you know, like, if you can just make some assumptions about what was, for example, the structure of the sausage or something, but you would expect that there is also like a difference between the amount of dark matter that must have been locked around, say, the half-life radius of that,
that's
of that
right.
thing. So,
so yeah,
of course, for each different realization, then
yes.
this ratio will vary differently as the merger proceeds.
That's right, which is why we wanted to kind of go with the empirical relations and to include the scatter in them,
yeah.
And to kind of at least address this problem, which is why the error bars are so huge, right?
Yeah,
thanks.
Yes.
So going back to the last plot again, yes. So I understand what you're doing with the substructure, fun, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite understand what you were doing for the smooth halo distribution. Was that from the stars or is that the standard?
That was from the stars. So basically when we were doing all the fit at once, yeah.
So my question on that is, okay, I didn't understand about the main halo.
Yeah.
So say, if I imagine the main halo has all disk stars, the main progenitor halo, and then there's a bunch of accretion.
Right.
But still, most of the dark matter, presumably, is from the main halo, not from the accretion, right?
So actually, no, it wasn't most of it. At least in the simulations, the way that we were looking at it, it wasn't. It is a non-trivial fraction, but basically all of this is contributing about half. So the other half is kind of, when we grouped it in the paper as, you know, other, which is smooth accretion, basically, yeah, all the other dark matter.
What distribution did that follow?
Oh, actually it was a lot more, it was very close to the virialized component, because the old stuff kind of tended to be a lot more kind of Gaussian.
How are you tracing that component?
We're not, which is why one of the things that I was saying.
Yes.
Yes. So this is basically here, with the large caveats that I hopefully kind of got across, is that the distribution that we're getting here is just from the very old accreted events, which is what I call here halo, as well as newer accretion events.
So what are you going to do with the other?
With the other? Well, so basically, we have a few ideas of trying to actually measure the local density, and basically kind of do a density game, and trying to estimate the density contribution of different ones, find the ratio there, and then we're still thinking about how we're going to get the velocity of those components, but work in progress.
Justin.
Yes.
Hi, lovely talk. I think you might have mentioned this in words, so I apologize if you already said this, but presumably you can take this idea and then, of course, apply it back to the fire simulations.
Yeah.
And then get your F of V and compare it to the actual F of V of the sims.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what this... Okay, I missed that. Sorry.
Yes.
Good. Thank you.
Awesome.
I just wanted to say that we also tried to measure this fraction.
Yes.
But of the total.
Exactly.
To the total. And so what we get is few percent to 10% at most. And I think there were one example when it reached 20, but typically it's few percent.
Yeah.
When you basically calculate the number, well, the amount of dark matter contributed by this large substructure compared to total locally.
Yes.
So which is what you said.
That is the reason why I added this,
so
people don't look at this number and then look at your number and say
they're
different.
Factor of several.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Your derived distribution of speeds there is quite different from the standard model. So could you just explain why it only affects the predictions for masses below about, what was it, 50 GeV?
Oh, yes, that's a good question. So basically this goes back to the way I was saying about integrating distributions. So I have distribution here, and then I have Vmin, which is basically depends on the mass of the dark matter and the threshold of the experiment. Okay, so basically if you have a high dark matter mass, the interaction kind of has a lot of energy already, so that brings your Vmin very low. So it's like here. So then you're integrating most of this distribution, which means that if you have a distribution like this and another distribution that kind of is like this, you're going to really more or less end up in there, both normalized to 1, you're going to end up with mostly the same amount F of V, with some very minor changes. Now, if you have a very, very low mass, you keep the same threshold, energy threshold, and you have a very low mass dark matter, then what you're integrating is actually here. So you can see that if you have this distribution versus this one, there will be a lot bigger changes, which is why in the direct detection exclusion plot, you actually, it really does affect the lower limit a lot more.
Okay, do we have more questions? We still have two minutes.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. All right, thank you.